There's no doubt about it, Isaiah is probably one of the best known of the Old Testament prophets, the son of Amos. In Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, he lived in the city of Jerusalem along with his prophetess wife and at least two sons, as we have record in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 3, and also in chapter 8, verse 3. And when we look at Isaiah, we understand that he was one who prophesied for a period of some 40 to 60 years during the reigns of four different kings. There was Uzziah, there was Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And we understand that Isaiah began his work the year that Uzziah died, as according to Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1. And thus Isaiah lived in a pivotal time in the history of the northern kingdom of Israel, along with the southern kingdom of Judah. It was during this time that Amos and Hosea were also preaching. They were his contemporaries in the northern kingdom, while on the other hand you had Micah and Isaiah, who labored in the southern kingdom of Judah. And so we understand that Isaiah's work was mainly concentrated in and around the city of Jerusalem, and it was alongside of the work that Micah was also doing. There's a tradition in the Talmud stating that Isaiah resisted Manasseh's idolatrous decrees, and as a result he was fastened between two boards and that he was sawn asunder. And if that's the case, it could very well be that which is referred to in the book of Hebrews chapter 11, verse 37. But in order for us to understand the events that are going to transpire and the oracle that he delivers in the 17th chapter, I think it would be good for us to go back and see the urgent need of the prophetic work during this particular period of time. And so we're going to go back to the time of Uzziah during his reign in the kingdom of Judah. And then during the latter portion of Uzziah's reign, we see this courageous prophet begin his work, which continued through, as we've already mentioned, the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah in the kingdom of Judah. The record states concerning Uzziah, "And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah did. And he sought God in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding in the visions of God. And as long as he sought the Lord, God made him to prosper." 2 Chronicles chapter 26, verses 4 and 5. And thus we recognize, for the most part, Uzziah was a righteous king. And even though we have that statement that was read a moment ago from 2 Chronicles chapter 26, in just 11 verses, the record then states, "But when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. For he transgressed against the Lord his God, and went into the temple of the Lord to burn incense upon the altar of incense." In verse 16, "And thus because of his transgression, Uzziah the king was a leper until the day of his death, and dwelt in a several house, being a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. And Jotham his son was over the king's house, judging the people of the land." And now, having been introduced to Jotham, the record states concerning him that he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Uzziah did. Howbeit, he entered not into the temple of the Lord, and the people did corruptly. In 2 Chronicles chapter 27 and verse 2. And then the record states in 2 Kings chapter 15 and verses 34 and 35, "Jotham did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. Howbeit, the high places were not removed. The people sacrificed and burned incense still in the high places." And then the last verse of 2 Kings chapter 15 says, "And Jotham slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David his father, and Ahaz his son reigned in his stead." And thus, having looked at the two reigns briefly as the statements are made, we're introduced now to Ahaz, which has been called the worst of all the kings of Judah. It's even been stated concerning Ahaz that he was the most despicable king that ever squatted on a throne. And anybody who knows anything about Ahaz will recognize the truthfulness of that statement. Unlike the last two kings of Judah, it says that Ahaz did not that which was right in the sight of his Lord, but walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. yea, and made his sons to pass through the fire, according to the abominations of the heathen. And this was according to the Molech worship of the Ammonites and the Moabites, who sacrificed their children in order to appease their gods. And it states also that he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree. 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 2 through 4. And also made molten images for Balaam. 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 2. And upon the death of Ahaz, we have the fourth king that reigned during the time that Isaiah prophesied. It says that Hezekiah began to reign when he was 5 and 20 years old, and he reigned 9 and 20 years in Jerusalem. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. 2 Chronicles chapter 29, verses 1 and 2. Just as his father Ahaz was a bad son of a good father, Jotham, we now have Hezekiah, who was the good son of a bad father, Ahaz. And even though Ahaz had left the kingdom morally and politically corrupt, and had almost but extinguished true religion through his abominable idolatrous practices, we recognize that Hezekiah wastes no time in trying to restore true worship to the true God. 2 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 3, and 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 3 through 6. And so when we look at the years of Isaiah's ministry, they can only be looked upon as a time of crisis morally, a time of crisis politically as well as religiously. On the one hand, we have the northern kingdom of Israel that was sinking deeper and deeper into idolatry despite the efforts of Amos and Hosea. And on the other hand, we have the ascension of Ahaz to the throne of Judah, rebelling against God and now introducing idolatry throughout the land. In their rebellion, the sins of Israel and Judah had devastated these divided kingdoms. And as the book of Isaiah begins, one is immediately made aware of the rebellion and the disrespect that was characteristic of God's children. At that particular time, when the record states, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they've rebelled against me. The ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel doth not know. My people doth not consider. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backward." Isaiah chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. And so here was a time when empires were emerging, alliances and coalitions were forming, and instead of God's people being loyal to the one true and living God, we see that God's people were playing the harlot. They were letting all of these outside influences overtake them, and how desperately they needed to be told about their perilous condition. But who would go? And then we're presented with one of the strongest yet clearest examples of a prophet's willingness to go. And it was Isaiah who said, "Here am I, send me." Isaiah means Jehovah is salvation. How appropriate that designation is, because that's the very lesson that God's people had forgotten. And that's the very lesson that God's people needed to learn once more. We see that here was a time when God's people needed comfort. Here was a time when God's people needed assurance, protection, strength, and security. And yet, in spite of all of the efforts to find these things in their alliances and in their confederacies and in their coalitions, based upon their own human powers and own human abilities, they needed to be reminded once again that these can only be found in the one true and living God. And so now, as we turn our attention to the 17th chapter of the book of Isaiah, in verses 1 through 3, we see now the oracle given concerning Damascus, and even as it's introduced as far as Israel is concerned. We immediately notice in verse 1 that the term burden is used. And burden is a denunciatory expression which is used in introducing this oracle concerning the judgment dealing with Damascus, the capital of Syria, and Israel in the following verses. Damascus is one of the most ancient and has been at all times one of the most important cities of Syria. We go back to Isaiah's day. Damascus, Syria, and Israel were confederates. And this reminds us of the earlier warning that we're given in this particular letter in Isaiah chapter 7, where Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the king of Israel, had formed an alliance one with another for the purpose of resisting the Assyrians from the east. These kings also want Judah's participation, but upon the refusal of Ahaz, Syria and Israel take evil counsel, as we're told in Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 5, to war against Judah and to set their own man upon the throne, even the son of Tabeel, verse 6. And when this news is received by Ahaz, his heart, as well as the heart of the people, is moved with fear. And thus Isaiah is commissioned to go to Ahaz, and Isaiah is told to take his son, Shear-Jashub, and to say to Ahaz, "Take heed and be quiet. Fear not, neither be faint-hearted, for the two tails of these smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin with Syria, and the son of Remaliah." Isaiah chapter 7, verse 4. And here's why. Even though they've taken this evil counsel against you, Ahaz, it shall neither stand, neither shall it come to pass. In verse 7, Damascus and Israel is two smoldering stumps are soon going to be snuffed out. What you need to realize, Ahaz, is that these are only men. And so here's the call of faith on the part of Ahaz. Here's the call of trust and reliance upon God instead of what men are able to do. And yet, in spite of this assurance that Isaiah gives, Ahaz calls upon the king of Assyria for help, as we're told in the book of 2 Kings chapter 16. In verse 7, thus the burden of Damascus, because of its involvement with Israel to go to war against Judah, Isaiah now repeats God's judgment upon Damascus. Damascus will be taken away from being a city. It shall be a ruinous heap. Judah having been attacked by both Syria and Israel, and as the record states in 2 Chronicles chapter 28 and verses 6 through 8, we have in one day 120,000 slain and another 200,000 taken captive. And thus Ahab now appeals to Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, for help. And after having received that present from Ahaz of silver and gold, we're told then the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried the people of it captive to Kir and slew Rezin. 2 Kings chapter 16 verse 9. We have Damascus now devastated, left in ruins, and her people taken captive. In verse 2, our attention now focuses on the cities of Aroer. These were cities around Aroer and its jurisdiction. It was near Rabbath Ammon, at the river of Gad, an arm of the Jabbok. 2 Samuel chapter 24, verse 5, founded by the Gadites, and Numbers chapter 32, verse 4. And where Syrian cities once stood, now in the oracle we're told that flocks are going to graze and they're going to lie down. They're not going to be frightened by anyone. And so the picture that we're presented is that cities that were once thriving are now going to be desolate. So much so that there wouldn't be anyone left to scare or to disturb the flocks. And in verse 3, attention is now raised as far as Ephraim, the northern kingdom of Israel. And she receives information concerning God's judgment as an ally with Damascus against Judah. A brief yet thorough description was given to Damascus, and now Ephraim is given the announcement that she will suffer devastation from the same forces that Damascus will face. Since they're allied together, when the crunch comes, they're both going to look alike. Notice, the fortress shall also cease from Ephraim. Ephraim is a synonym for Israel because of that tribe's leading influence over the northern kingdom. And even with all of its towered and all of its walled cities and all of the garrison in terms of military strength, these things are going to be defenseless. And the kingdom, notice, from Damascus and the remnant of Syria, like Israel, Syria would also fall, and both of them are going to share a common glory. The glory is captivity. feeling so secure because of her alliance with Syria. Israel now finds herself in the undignified position of being dealt with in the very same manner as the heathen, to their shame. One of the statements that's going to be made a little bit later concerning Israel is the fact that she had forgotten God. She had forgotten the law. And had they been mindful of the law, they would have been mindful of what the law stated in Leviticus chapter 25 and verses 45 and 46. For had they known God's law, they would have known that enslavement of their own brethren was forbidden. And so now they're being dealt with in the undignified position, the same as the heathen. Tiglath-Pileser took Damascus captive and killed the Syrian king in 2 Kings chapter 16 in verses 7 through 9. And 10 years later, 722 to 721 B.C., Israel fell to the very same power at the hand of Shalmaneser in 2 Kings chapter 17 verses 1 through 6. According to the Assyrian inscriptions, the king of Assyria that actually captured Samaria was not Shalmaneser, but rather Sargon. Sargon claims to have taken the city in the first year of his reign, which was 721 B.C. But now, having introduced this oracle concerning Syria and Israel, attention is now focused upon Israel. A time of leanness is coming. After the destructive forces of God's judgment have done their work, the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. And perhaps this is a reference to 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 21, so worded as to recall the departure of the glory during the days of Eli, when Israel was overcome by the Philistines and the ark of God was taken. And now, because of Israel and their sin against the one who had delivered them from their bondage in Egypt and had adopted now the many idolatrous practices which had been expressly forbidden. And this is what we see in that giving of the law. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And now they'd even formed alliances and even gone to battle against their brother nation Judah. And so we recognize that Israel truly had been weighed in the balance, Daniel chapter 5, verse 27, and had been found wanting. She has sown to the wind, and so she's going to reap the whirlwind, Hosea chapter 8, verse 7. Once again, they're going to be made aware of the fact that righteousness indeed exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people, Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34. And that pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18. Payday is coming. In verse 5 it says, in that day it shall be as when the harvestman gathers the corn and reapeth the ear with his arm. And so we see that Isaiah now uses agricultural terms to describe the events when Assyria comes upon Israel, and it'll be like the harvestman gathering his crop that's ripe for the harvest. And once again, the reference is given concerning the Valley of Rephaim. And it's no doubt used because of its fertile soil and its plenteous crops, and because of its productivity and because of its proximity to Jerusalem. It made it a very attractive prize that was often seized by the Philistines in the days of David. No doubt, in making reference to this valley known for its abundance and its importance, it's going to really emphasize the impact of the events that are now going to come upon them. And so in verse 6, the judgment upon Israel will be like the gathering of grapes and as the shaking of an olive tree. We go back to the law of Moses. And in the book of Leviticus chapter 19 in verses 9 and 10, the law of Moses stated, when ye reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest. And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and the stranger. And then again in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 20, when thou beatest thine olive tree, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. Thus judgment, in dealing with the judgment that's going to come upon Israel, It's going to be like the gathering of grapes and like the gathering of olives from the tree. Only a few, only a remnant is going to remain. And at that time, instead of placing their confidence and trust in men and in the things of men, notice that it says in verse 7, a man will now look to his Maker and have respect unto the Holy One of Israel. You know, this is something that always amazes me, that men have the tendency to forget about God when everything's going right and going good and going the way that they think that it ought to be going. I mean, how easily it becomes for us to look and to absorb and to be satisfied as long as things are like we want them to be. And as a result, we forget about God. We forget about the one who made us. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. The one who provides for us. Matthew chapter 6, verses 25 through 33. The one who cares for us. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7. The one who gives us the true victory. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 57. Yet when men have to face something about to overwhelm them and something that's beyond their own powers to resolve, it's then and only then that some will begin to seek their Maker. And then even at best, they want to make a deal. Instead of realizing in Him we live and move and have our very being. Acts chapter 17, verse 28. Many simply regard God as an appendix. When all else fails, now I'll turn to God. Thus, in regard to Israel's calamity, it says that a man will now look, and a man will now have respect. That means to look away from all else now at one object. They will now look to God. In verse 8, we find that he no longer places his trust. He no longer places his confidence in the altars. He no longer placed his confidence and his trust in the work of his hands, that which his fingers have made, the groves or the images. And it shows us somewhat how deeply steeped in idolatry they had become. 2 Kings chapter 17 in verses 6 through 18 gives great detail concerning the fact that Israel was steeped in their idolatry, because it says that they walked in the statutes of the heathen, in verse 8. They did secretly those things that were not right. They built the high places, verse 9. They set them up images and groves, verse 10. They burned incense in all the high places, as did the heathen, verse 11. They served idols, verse 12. They made molten images, even two calves, made a grove and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal, verse 16. And even though they no longer shall look and have respect unto these things, and now look and have respect to God, it'll be too late. And so in verse 9, in the day of calamity, Isaiah states that once strong cities will be like the empty forest, and the only way to describe the land would be a site of desolation, as the leavings of the wood. Or as Moffat renders the passage, your town shall be deserted like Amorite and Hivite ruins. Thus the thought would be, just as the Amorites and Hivites were run off and their cities are left in ruins, so will be the strong and fortified cities of Israel. When will men learn that they can never possess such great strength and build any kind of fortress that God cannot overwhelm and reduce to ruins? Men try every way possible to guard against God's invasion of their selfish goals, their selfish aims, their pursuits of life. Nonetheless, all such efforts are fruitless, and they're futile against God, who spake and it was done, who commanded and it stood fast, Psalm 33, verse 9. And by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things. And by him all things consist. Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. The reason for this punishment is now brought to our attention in verse 10. In the plainest terms that he could possibly put forth, we're told that Israel has forgotten. But not only forgotten, Israel has not been mindful of God. And because of their neglect and failure, Israel has removed herself from the true source of her strength. This was a willful lapse of memory. And a failure to be aware of the one true and living God who was able to help and deliver and strengthen. They would have done well to remember the words of David in Psalm 18 and verses 1 through 3. I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength in whom I trust, my buckler and the horn of my salvation and my high tower. I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. You notice the terms that David uses? I mean, the terms that he used stand for the place where refuge is to be found. A stronghold where one is protected. Guidance where one is permitted to escape from his enemies. A shield for one. Power granted for one. A height that grants security. And thus we recognize that David's confidence is in God, who is his deliverer, who is his strength and his salvation. But notice, having forgotten God, they plant pleasant plants and set it with strange slips. And more than likely, this is an allusion to their bringing in of the foreign gods and the idolatrous practices, which had been mentioned earlier in verse 8. And so in verse 11, like the farmer labors hard to ensure that successful yield from the time of planting till the time of harvest, so Israel has done the same with its foreign gods. It has sown the seeds of idolatry. And they've cultivated them well. And their anticipation and expectation concerning the harvest, they're not going to reap what they expect. The day of harvest will find them reaping grief and desperate sorrow. What a tragedy. What a sad picture. Barrenness and waste where there should have been life and plenty. And yet this is a picture of the fate of many who've persisted in their rejection of God and in their clinging to false hopes. We're living in a world. We're living in a midst of people that this is characteristic of. Desperate sorrow is the natural result of discovering that the time for securing a profitable harvest is now gone. Doesn't that sound very much like the statement of Jeremiah? In chapter 8 and verse 20, where he says, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. In verse 12. And as one walks in wisdom, redeeming the time, he should seek those things which are above, and set his affection on things above, not on things of the earth. Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Thus the warning, be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well-doing. For in due season we shall reap, if we faint not. Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 9. A choice is going to have to be made by all. God has given man the freedom of choice. And thus we're going to have to base that choice upon the evidence that God has presented in His Word. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. A deliberate choice can be made based upon the knowledge and understanding of His will. And hopefully the choice will be to seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. In verses 12 through 14, we have the destruction of Judah's enemies. The coming of the Assyrian power is described as the multitude of many peoples. And it's presented in terms of an onrushing tide of an agitated sea. The Assyrians, as they first invaded Damascus and then Israel and then eventually Judah, are presented in terms of a nation of might and power which has the destructive force like the rushing of mighty waters, which is able to overwhelm and able to consume everything in its path. In the record that we have of Sennacherib in 2 Kings chapter 19 in verses 23 through 26, it says that he boasted of crossing the mountains of Lebanon, invading houses and destroying the trees of Carmel. The desert couldn't stop him. He dug wells. He drank strange waters. The rivers couldn't stop him. He crossed them as if they were dry land. And because of this mighty power, the inhabitants were dismayed and confounded. However, after being used to accomplish the Lord's purpose as the rod of his anger, Isaiah chapter 10 verse 5, this military war machine would be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind. God was in control, and though Isaiah had warned the Assyrian king that God knew of his doings, and even though he knew that, he also knew that it wouldn't be without rebuke. In verse 14, God would not allow Israel to fall to one who had so defiantly boasted against it. God had said, I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. In 2 Kings chapter 19, verse 34. And he would do so upholding his honor and keeping his promise to David. The phrase at eventide, trouble and before the morning, he is not, is very significant. And the reason for its significance is because that's exactly the way God dealt with them. We look in the book of 2 Kings chapter 19 in verses 35 through 37 and also in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 in verses 21 and 22. And there we have the record of the angel of the Lord who went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000 who were all of the mighty men of valor, the men who were leaders, the men who were the captains in the camp. And thus Sennacherib made haste and returned with shame of face to his own land and was slain by his own sons with the sword. Isaiah chapter 37, verse 38. Thus we should take heed to the wise counsel of Solomon. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogance and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate. Counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength. By me kings reign, and princes decree justice. By me princes rule, and nobles, even all the judges of the earth. Proverbs chapter 8, verses 13 through 16. Brethren, for whatever things were written aforetime, were written for our instruction. Romans chapter 15, verse 4. And all these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. History doesn't have to repeat itself. We dare not forget God and reject His counsel. We will face a terrible tragedy, the horrible consequences of eternal separation and damnation. Let's examine our lives lest we forget and not be mindful then of the devotion and dedication and loyalty which is due Almighty God and fall as did Israel and later Judah. And as we had stated a moment ago from Romans chapter 8 verse 31, if God be for us, who can be against us?